What is scarier? The incomprehension of otherworldly dangers like ghosts and vampires and creatures of the night and vengeful spirits that we can't understand, or the real-life horrors and sorrow of crippling mental illness, cruelty towards children, poverty and destitution, and the cold judgment that society puts on people in those conditions? Because all of that is found in this novel.
Holy shit, Viper.
Happy Halloween, Lillian! Woo!
And to you, Piper. Happy Halloween to you.
Thank you very much. I have a candle. I'm wearing a hat so I can pretend I'm almost in costume. It's all yes. dark because we're recording at night. It's very spooky.
We're recording at night and it's pouring rain outside my house and I can hear the rain. I don't think it's loud enough in here that the mic's going to pick it up. But as I was preparing my notes, I was sitting in my bedroom, which has a much closer to the ceiling. And it was just pouring down rain as I was like writing down. And this is a dramatic thing that Jane Eyre does.
Awesome. The mood is set. I really love this concept, Lillian, for our Halloween kind of week episode, is that we're discussing the gothic elements of Jane Eyre. And it seems like something when you just kind of think about it at first, you're like, duh, I mean, it's like a gothic novel. But then you kind of dive into the details and you're like, this is actually kind of like the perfect story for Halloween.
It is. That's one of the things, like when we tried to do our Halloween palette cleanser, I kept Googling for like lists of period dramas that are kind of like spooky or fall or like, and all of the lists were like, just watch Jane Eyre. And I was like, yeah, that's what we always do.
It's like, come on, give us a break. Give us something else, something like that. Not quite that.
Yes. The other thing too is I did something we talked about right before we started recording is we both did some Googling about gothic literature because it's easy to forget that we're two goobers on this podcast and we don't actually know what we're talking about, but we are. And so I was Googling it and I found some definitions and other things. And I kept coming across how deeply intertwined Jane Eyre is with all of gothic literature, because a lot of the lists that I read, Jane Eyre was an example. Wuthering Heights had the same thing. I was trying to figure out how old gothic literature was, because it seems relatively new to me. And one of my favorite facts that I learned is that gothic literature, I've always thought it was kind of weird that gothic architecture and gothic literature had the same name. And I always thought they just had like similar vibes. I didn't realize the architecture came first.
Yeah.
So it's the they were reading these books and they're like, it's kind of like those like spooky churches and stuff. Like that's the energy of this book.
For sure. In the research that I did, two of the articles that I referenced, which I referenced maybe three or four total, so half of the articles that I referenced, both cited a book written by Horace Walpole in 1764 called The Castle of Otranto as kind of like the original gothic novel. So
that's what I saw as well. And what I found really interesting about that is that's only 83 years prior to Jane Eyre being written. So to give you an idea of like how long ago that was, that's 1940. So it's not
compared to us.
That's like a whole new type of art.
Yeah.
That came about 80 years prior to the Brontes writing these books. And one of the other articles that I read was about like, when did these become popular? Like, when did gothic literature become popular? And three articles that I saw, I just read the little like Google snippet, all attributed it to the Brontes novels as part of the peak popularization of this genre.
Yeah. Mr. Walpole might have invented it, but the Brontes made it cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we talked beforehand because we both had a similar approach to kind of how we're going to talk about this topic. And I think it's the IB literature people in us that are like, we need to have like a, you know, we have to understand the terms and like, how do you break down this genre of fiction?
We need a structure for it.
Exactly. So we both ended up accidentally kind of doing a Google search of like, what are kind of the elements of a classic Gothic novel and Gothic literature. So we each have a list, and I think they're pretty similar. But Lillian, I think you're going to read yours because you have a bit more than I do.
Mine's a little longer than yours, although I do have things that I'm not 100% certain we can tie directly to Jane Eyre. I did also want to start. I did also want to start with defining it, because I did, in defining it, it does feel like they're defining Jane Eyre, which is so funny to me because we talk a lot about how this is intertwined with so many other things, but I honest to goodness think in this case, a lot of times the people writing these definitions are looking at Jane Eyre and going, what makes this creepy? Like, what about this makes it creepy? And they're looking at books like this, like Dracula, like some of the other novels around this time that were had this sort of like creepiness to them, and went, what about it? Like, tell me about that.
By Mary Shelley. Anything by Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes. I don't mean like bad artist, but like something about Edgar Allan Poe, like he ding, dang, done did it and creeps me out.
So quick tangent. It's so funny. Okay. So one of Sam and I's favorite series is, you can call it a series, but on Netflix, there's The Haunting of Hill House. It's all made by the same guy, Mike Flanagan. He also had The Haunting of Bly Manor. He also had Midnight Mass, a couple other things. His most recent show is The Fall of the House of Usher, and it's all based on Edgar Allan Poe poems. And it's so funny because there's a lot of his poetry that's like actually put into the dialogue of these modern day characters. And we were literally in between watching an episode and I paused it and I looked at Sam and I'm like, okay, I can't say this without sounding like a total idiot. But every time I hear like one of the snippets that's definitely from an Edgar Allan Poe poem, I'm just like, damn, this guy's like a pretty good writer.
No, I mean,
he's a really good poet, actually.
But to be fair to that version of Piper, that's also the version of Piper and Lillian that show up to this podcast, because we started reading this book and went, you know what? Jane Eyre, pretty good.
It's like surprisingly one of the greatest novels of like Eastern literature, or no, sorry, Western literature, if only, is the Japanese adaptation of Jane Eyre. So. No, it's just incredible. But anyway,
yeah,
give us these definitions.
It's so good. So here's the definition was, because I would have defined it prior to reading these definitions as like, what's the part that feels kind of spooky? And how they defined it was like a real definition, which is Gothic literature is defined as writing that employs dark and picturesque scenery, startling and melodramatic narrative devices, an overall atmosphere of exoticism, mystery, fear, and dread.
Ooh.
And then all of these definitions said Gothic novels often start with an ancient. I always say that word wrong. Old. It's like the old house.
Ancient.
I'm saying that right?
Say it as a CH. Ancient.
Truly hate that. ancient house. It is not spelled that way. So technically English is wrong. I just want to say. House that conceals a terrible secret or serves as a refuge, especially for frightening and threatening character.
Just like my story, A Dance with the Dead. You can get it online at adancewiththedead.com. Anyway.
In case anybody who maybe doesn't listen to every episode of our podcast and doesn't know our personalities, this is a P. Cleavy episode. This is an episode that is more in line with what P. Cleavy enjoys than what Lillian enjoys.
Dude,
I like the kisses.
Yeah, the kisses are good. But I think, Lillian, you'll have a lot of interesting commentary when we get to the second half of today's episode, because I got some really good discussions for us.
Nice.
Yeah.
So starting with our list of tropes, because that's where we're going to structure it. I think the first one was in the definition. I think it fits really well with Jane Eyre pretty specifically, which is, it is often set in a haunted castle or house.
Yep.
Thornfield is haunted.
Or mansion. There you go. Bada bing, bada boom. Check. Next.
We did do a whole episode on Thornfield, so I didn't want to spend too much time talking on it. Similarly, we have an episode lined up to talk about nature. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to dwell too much in nature, although that is also a very gothic element, which was something I didn't know. I didn't realize that like the connections to nature and leveraging nature in your narrative is a very gothic thing. So I learned something new.
Yeah. And I think the element of that in a gothic sense is the way that nature is changeable. It has no care for the humans who find themselves caught up in it. It's unforgiving. It is kind of wild and dangerous. I think that's the gothic element of nature.
Yeah, I love that. I think the second piece here that it did take me a minute to figure out how I felt about this one, but I do think is in Jane Eyre, and I'm curious about your thoughts before I share mine, is the idea of a damsel in distress.
Yeah, I also came across that one of a woman in distress. And it, I mean, there's definitely women who are in distress in this book. There's, I mean, Bertha's situation is very stressful and she's very distressed about it. I think Jane, in a lot of elements of her life, finds herself distressed by yeah. the things that she has to deal with. I think just because a woman is in distress doesn't mean she can't handle the situation. Literally mm-hmm. think of Meg from Hercules. I'm a woman. I'm in distress. I have this. Like you can go on and like go on with your day. It's all right.
Here's the thing. I did not define damsel in distress in such gendered ways like you did. And I agree that generally we think of damsel in distress as women. But it something about that like hit wrong for me when I thought about Jane. I was like, I don't know that she's a damsel in distress, but you know who is a damsel in distress?
Rochester.
Mr. Rochester. He falling is off constantly his horse, in distress.
Almost getting burned alive. Also, Dick Mason getting attacked by his sister. There's a lot of distress in this.
I think that Rochester is the damsel in distress, and that checks the box for me as a gothic element of Jane Eyre.
Easy peasy.
But yeah, then the third one that I have here is an atmosphere of mystery and suspense.
Yep. And that is 100% also Thornfield. I mean, yeah. I think that's where we have to mostly focus that in the discussion is the mystery surrounding the house, the secrets therein, the way that Jane feels when she first arrives, and it's very like dark and quiet and empty, and how sometimes we've talked a lot about how it can be like the house kind of changes based on who's in the room and what energy is filling it. But I think because Bertha's energy kind of haunts this place, and especially for Rochester's perspective, mm-hmm. it makes the place very mysterious, suspenseful, haunting. 100% that's there.
Yeah. And I think what was interesting to me in kind of thinking about that and thinking about the gothic elements of the book in general is that the earlier parts, also Jane's childhood has a lot of very gothic elements. Her experience mm-hmm. at Gateshead, just in her time alone, and then her experience in the Red Room, her experience in Lowood, it's less a haunting atmosphere as much as there's a couple other elements here that I'll draw back to Lowood. But I definitely think Jane's whole life has that. And in some ways, having that kind of sad, dark childhood mm-hmm. would make someone reflect on their life in the way that Jane does in the novel, which is meant to be this autobiography of focusing on these creepier, more gothic elements.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that too, because I had almost forgotten that it is in her childhood at Gateshead where this first mm-hmm. kind of idea of ghosts is presented. When she's locked up in the Red Room, and I believe it's like one of the maids, if not Bessie, who like kind of threatens her, where it's like, if you don't stop screaming or if you don't behave, like a ghost is going to come down that chimney and grab you. Mm-hmm. And that's like what she's afraid of because her uncle died in that room. And some movie adaptations and TV adaptations really like take that interpretation like visually pretty far. Like we will see like the ghost of her uncle and mm-hmm. things like that. And it's, I like that they introduced that very early on because then it lays the seeds for later, you know, when she's mm-hmm. kind of like joking with Mrs. Fairfax, like, oh, like, could there be a ghost here? Ha ha ha. But like weird things are happening. And she's like, but wait, what if there is one? Wouldn't that be horrible? There's a fly. I'm trying to grab it.
I want you guys to know that while Piper's talking about a ghost, she's sort of like reaching out at something I can't see and like pawing at the air. And I'm like, is there a ghost with you now? Blink twice if you're not okay.
Yes, it's the ghost of Charlotte Bronte. She's trying to take the microphone away from me. And I'm like, Charlotte, just sit in your corner. Stop it.
Listen, if you wanted us to not talk about you, you should have said something a long time ago. We're coming up on 2 years of this, honey.
She's only just developed her poltergeist abilities. She's like, do you know how long it took me to even like move like a brush of hair?
I like the idea of her like... She was always sort of fine with being dead and not being able to engage in the world until we started doing this podcast. And then she spent 2 years trying to make us stop.
She's like, this is the last straw, you guys. You shut up. Char, babe, Char, chill.
But the next one on my list actually ties really well into what we were just talking about, which is all of these are pretty overlapping, but a ghost or a monster, which I think the ghost of her uncle kind of, but mostly Bertha. Yep. That bitch is so gothic.
Yeah. And I even love how there are so many wonderful things before the truth is revealed in the story where I almost wish I could like wipe my memory and like go back and reread it and get surprised again. Cause it's like, but what if it is a ghost kind of a thing? It's like, I'm not sure what kind of novel this is yet. Like, will they make it a supernatural thing or will it be like a reasonable explanation kind of a deal? So yeah,
I love it.
Bertha is our ghost. She's very spooky.
Ooh, spooky Bertha. It's hard for me to see Bertha as anything other than my crazy friend. Like some at some point along this journey, I started seeing Bertha as like, she's just sort of nuts, but she should stop living with Rochester and come live with me.
Lillian's ready to take on that responsibility. Oh my god.
Yes.
I know I called it back on a recent episode, but it's still like one of my favorite creative choices from Wide Sargasso Sea when they, at the end of the book, she's in the house and she hears people talking about the ghost of Thornfield, which is her, and she's creeping around the halls and she's like, gotta watch out for that ghost everyone's talking about. It's just like the cutest, saddest thing. Love that.
That's the Bertha I need to give a hug to. I really feel like it would help her out. The next trope was the weather is always awful.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Very gloomy.
Very, a lot of the spooky things that happen around Thornfield are blamed on the weather.
Well, the very first sentence, there was no chance for a walk that day.
That's a great point.
It sets her up. The weather sets
the whole book up. Mm-hmm. The example in the article was the Wuthering Heights scene where Kathy runs after Heathcliff in the storm.
Oh, yeah. Stormy. I took a deep breath.
You as took if I was a breath going, like you were going to say something.
And then it left me. So Charlotte took my thought away from me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How dare she?
Yeah.
And then the next one that I have is one that I believe is also on your list, which is dreaming and nightmares.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And bad omens. Yeah. There is so much kind of like prophesizing in Jane Eyre. And I think it kind of leads into the somewhat supernatural elements that do kind of exist. Jane definitely has visions in her dreams of things that will come. And also it's mostly Charlotte Bronte providing foreshadowing, but there's lots of things that characters say, like definitely. And I know we talked about this with the biblical thing, that it's like actually a Bible reference that like Rochester essentially predicts his own future injuries of like, you know, being blind and like being deformed in different ways and stuff like that. So there's lots of dreams warning characters of things, them kind of like almost, yeah, previsioning stuff, and then all kinds of spooky things.
I think the example that I think of the most with this is the dream that she has shortly before their wedding, of her being outside Thornfield and not being able to get in and all that stuff. And I think that it's such an interesting narrative choice to take this, the way that Charlotte Bronte like frames so many of these things in this, like, you're not quite sure what's real.
Yeah.
And it's like Rochester is King Gaslight. Mm-hmm. But Jane having this really vivid imagination. I mean, you and I've talked about our own imaginations a lot on this show. But Jane having this really vivid imagination, having these really vivid dreams, and then experiencing Bertha coming into the room and ripping her veil, and Rochester being able to disguise that in claiming that it's like this dream, wake, half awake, half asleep. You saw someone come in and rip your veil, but it wasn't a new person or a monster or anything like that. It was this other situation. Like, I can't imagine reading that not knowing what that is. Like, that's terrifying.
Yeah, seriously. It's so much great kind of layering. And it's one thing that, again, how amazing would it be to like have an interview with Charlotte Bronte to be like, okay, so how much of the full story did you have figured out before you sat down and started writing? Mm-hmm. Because there's so many layers to it that it's like, okay, if you know how this is going to end, you can really like kind of pepper in those details, but then lay these levels of supernatural kind of like red herrings and diversions and doubt. And it's just like, ooh, which way do you want to take this? Could be either. Yeah.
But I think the next one is the example in the article that I read was literally Rochester, which is a burdened male protagonist.
Burdened?
Burdened.
Ah, yes, he's very burdened.
He carries such a big weight, the poor sad baby.
It's very true. Yeah, I also had on my list villains and anti-heroes, and I feel like he falls into kind of the anti-hero category.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Heathcliff much more so, but Rochester definitely. Certainly to an extent.
Oh, I remember in the Hot and Bothered podcast season when they talked about Jane Eyre, they talked a lot about the influences of the Byronic hero, popularized by Lord Byron, and how it was very likely that the Bronte sisters read books with characters like this and then kind of put that into their leading male characters as well. So there's some homework for you, audience. Go look into the history of the Byronic hero, and you get a lot of angsty, moody boys.
which I do think burdened male protagonist, sure, that fits Rochester. But I truly think that he's better described by damsel in distress.
Very nice. Especially when he's wearing his female fortune teller costume.
Men get to be burdened and women are in distress. Mm-hmm. I don't love it.
Yeah. Well, change it, Lillian. Do something about it.
I know. I'm going to, starting by calling Rochester a damsel in distress on our podcast.
Perfect. Love it.
We rely on you, listeners, to take this out into the world. Anytime somebody says that Rochester is a burdened male protagonist, go, I don't know. I feel like he's more a damsel in distress.
Mm-hmm. He's the damsel.
The next one on my list fits very well in what you were saying, which is just generally melodrama. Mm-hmm. Which is a very P. Cleavy whole situation.
I love it. I love it so much. The articles that I were finding was talking about both melodrama and then just another way of saying that is just like high levels of emotion, which mm-hmm. it's like, oh, who doesn't want a story though, where people are just like, you know, so full of every possible emotion. It's like, oh, I love this person so much that my only option is to lie and cheat and murder and do all this stuff. And I will go to the ends of the world for you. What do you want? Anything for a smooch. So dramatic.
I think our listeners are probably well within the range of people who would enjoy that. But this did make me think of something from our lives recently. So we're going to just quick do a little jaunt off the Jane Eyre track because Piper and I, with some of our friends, watched the classic melodrama this weekend.
Yes, we did. I had a 1950s cocktail party, and it was intended to be a double feature. We watched...
but we got too sleepy because we're all old now.
Yes. Although, okay. So to finish the setup, so the two movies we were going to watch, the one that we did watch was All That Heaven Allows, which is often considered by like the Criterion Collection and like all these other like very, you know, formidable, influential groups that is kind of like the peak, like American melodrama kind of film. Mm-hmm. But it's very like autumn and it's all bright colors and technicolor and just beautiful like 50s clothes and romance and it's over the top love. And we watched that, and then we played a game of Quiplash, and then a lot of people went home. And then the next morning, I watched the second movie that we were going to watch together, which is a movie made in the 2000s that is made in homage to that one, called Far From Heaven. And it is a stunning film with, like, incredible acting and just beautiful visuals. But it's a good thing, I think, that we didn't watch that at the party, because it is so depressing. It's, like, really sad movie, and definitely would have been a big bummer for the end of the party. So
yeah,
I still think people should watch it. Not a party movie.
And it's not a Lillian movie, I don't think. It doesn't seem like I need my romances to have that happily ever after. Mm-hmm. I loved watching All That Heaven Allows with our friends. It Yay. Was a blast because we had just the right amount of, like, enjoying it sincerely. And then also, it's the 50s. There was a lot of low-hanging fruit for making fun of.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but I really enjoyed watching that together. But that is what, when I read melodrama now, I'm going to picture a man seeing the love of his life come back for him and then slipping off a cliff.
Yeah.
And then being left in the snow.
And then having a sexy coma by a roaring fireplace. And the lady comes back to him and the nurse is like, you should leave him alone. And she's like, no, I will stay by his side. And she opens the window to let some light upon his handsome chiseled face. And then the deer that they fed together in the snow comes up to the glass and peers through just as he starts to stir. And she's like, you came back. And she's like, I came home. And it's so cute. And the music just swells as it says the end.
But that's so very Jane Eyre. Just the, like, he fell off a cliff, his house burnt down, same man.
Yeah.
But they're burdened men. They're not damsels in distress.
Oh, okay. Okay. Gotcha.
Just to be clear, so that we all understand our gender roles.
I mean, he was pretty in distress falling off a cliff. Like, help, help, I'm in distress.
Oh my god. Then the next one's slightly less fun, which is death.
Yep.
Death is all up in Jane Eyre.
Well, she starts off as an orphan. She knows that her uncle's dead and it scares her. She befriends a girl who soon dies and tells her about the afterlife, and it's just death, death, death all the time.
And I think the most interesting commentary on death in the book is actually Atwood, mm-hmm. and kind of the way that she talks about all of these young girls dying and the way the adults around them reacted and the way that that left this opportunity for Jane to go out into nature and connect more with nature. It gave her more food, like this weird way that a child would interpret and understand death. Mm-hmm. And knowing that Charlotte Bronte went through experiences like that as a child, not specifically the way Jane was. She wasn't at the school, but like her sisters died, two of her older sisters died. Mm-hmm. And then she went to a school very similar to Lowood. And the way that an adult would reflect back on how that experience was for a child and the way that death is never as death is tragic always, mm-hmm. But it's never as clear cut as that. It's never just that. There's always more things to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's something that Rochester sees in her as well, that because mm-hmm. she had such kind of like a harsh, gloomy, sad upbringing, it's kind of given her this different sort of level-headed perspective about the world. So even though she is but like this 18-year-old girl who hasn't gone anywhere or seen anything, she's experienced already some of the hardest things that someone is asked to experience in life, unlike Blanche Ingram or some of these other mm-hmm. people who have been kind of protected by their wealth and their privilege. And I think as Rochester, also a man who has experienced great suffering, to see that similarity in this young woman, and he's like, whoa, how the hell do you have the same look about you that mm-hmm. I have in me? What did you go through? I went through something. Let's bond over this.
Well, and I think as you were talking about that, it reminded me of how much death has also been a factor that was defining for Rochester's life, mm-hmm. because his brother and father planned as if they were going to continue to live at least as long as our Edward did. and instead, their untimely deaths made all of the pain and suffering that Rochester went through when he was young, and that continues to haunt his life, unimportant. It was a moot point. If they had known they were going to die, obviously he wouldn't have been in the situation he was in. He wouldn't have been forced to go do the things. There's a lot of shoulda, coulda, wouldas with Rochester's family. But I think about the way that death would seem to Rochester as this inevitability that is going to dramatically change the lives of those around you. And the fact that that death was part of what made him realize that the rules of life are so unimportant.
Yeah, absolutely. Dang, dude, we're doing it again. We're getting deep.
Look at us go. Let's talk about the beast within, which is number 10.
Okay. I mean, Rochester has some of that. He has the exterior look of a gentleman, but he has this short temper and is rather like violent and explosive sometimes. Bertha definitely has a beast within her, which is more outside than in a lot of the times, especially the way she's described, like on four legs, running around like an animal and all this other stuff. I think you could even argue that Jane, her strength could be seen by a different like society as she has this beast within her as well. But they're like, oh, yeah, your pride and your power, like put that away. You should be so much more like bashful and stuff. And she's like, nope. It's not me, baby.
Well, and I think Jane is such an interesting character to think about that beast within idea with, because certainly when we see her at the very beginning, when she's starting to rebel for the first time, there's a lot of beast-like ways that she behaves. John Reed, who definitely earned it, gets beaten over the head with a book by Jane. Mm-hmm. And that's fairly beastly of her. I personally think it was a sane reaction by a child who was being bullied. But certainly the adults around her, certainly the adults around her do not think that that's okay. He's the one who beat her with a book. I forgot. She just attacked him with her nails and stuff.
Yeah. He he chucked a book at her and it the book either made her bleed or she hit her head because of the book and then she bled. And then she jumped on him and clawed his face to bits.
Yeah.
Nice.
But I also think that the adults around her wanted that beast to die. They wanted that kind of, which from what I was reading, the beast within in Gothic things is often literal with things like werewolves and vampires and things like that. But it's also more of a metaphor for this human thing that we have a tendency to forget, that we're animals and we have animal desires like sex, but also like food and a connection to nature and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting to see how that shifts in Jane, as she becomes more palatable in some ways for society and less palatable for some people still.
Yeah.
But I also think that the idea of that metaphor of Bertha as an aspect of Jane and the way that that kind of haunts her mind, I think that feels similar to me as well.
Absolutely. And even just what you mentioned with the nature thing too. I mean, we talked a lot about when we discussed that chapter, that how Jane wishes she could be like that lizard who could survive on the rocks and the moors, but she, unlike the lizard, requires more help to survive in the nature. So
yeah, I think that's something that I thought about quite a bit. I sort of diverted my notes away from that, but I think that section where Jane is out living on the moors, the way that she sees the light that ends up bringing her back, her attempt to kind of live in nature and the fact that these storms and all of these other things make that impossible. That feels very Gothic to me, but I want to go more in depth in that as we're talking about nature. So I don't want to spoil our own podcast.
Agreed. What's our next thing?
That's all 10.
Wonderful.
Do you have anything else on your list that I missed?
My one, I think that wasn't touched on is romance. One of my lists included romance. The other one did not, but I included it because I like it.
Good.
Yes. I think it falls into the melodrama and the passion. How could you have that without romance? It has to be there.
Well, and I think it's a piece that I think of romance as not Gothic. I think of romance as there can be sad things in it. There can be tough things. I love an action, scary, damsel in distressy, a lot of these things. But in the end, I would like it to be happy. And I think P. Cleavey is a little bit more of a, everybody could die.
I love a tragic romance. I really do. But so one of the next things that we wanted to talk about, I personally, and also thinking about this topic, made, I picked two adaptions myself that I thought okay. were the most gothic. Do you have something that comes to your mind off the top of your head that you could answer right away? Or should I share mine and then that'll give you time to think about what you think is the most gothic adaptations?
I think there's quite a few gothic adaptations that jump to mind. I don't know that I have more honorable mentions than I do my most gothic. Mm-hmm. But like the TV movies do a lot of, they lean into the gothic a lot. I think they're trying to appeal to the people who like the spook scares mm-hmm. as much as they are the people who like the romance. But I think there are a couple that hop to mind as more specifically gothic. But let's start with yours.
I would say my top two most gothic movie adaptations is the 1943 Orson Welles. And yeah. I think that movie very intentionally was made with the purpose to kind of be this kind of scary, suspenseful mm-hmm. story with a bit of romance involved as well. I mean, it was kind of like the like passion project of Orson Welles to do it this way. He kind of started his career in a lot of kind of spooky horror with his whole like War of the Worlds and all that other stuff that he did. This is, I mean, the fact that it is filmed in black and white, it adds to that kind of gothic mm-hmm. horror element of movies from that time. It's very film noir, which is a genre that we could dive very in depth with when discussing mm-hmm. and analyzing this film. And a lot of film noir also includes similar elements to this, these elements of like mystery and suspense. In the film language of it, lighting is very crucial. And there's many scenes in the 43 where they use very dramatic shadows. And in fact, it is the shadows themselves that hide Bertha. Mm. So, and I think also the fact that like Bertha is treated more as this kind of mysterious monster in the shadows than like a real person, as we've talked about many times, also leads into this kind of haunted house ghost story more so than a lot of other versions do. So I think that one is definitely high on the list for a yeah. gothic adaptation.
I think as you're talking about that, I also feel like there's a lot of elements that I've previously considered just sort of like odd choices that they did during her childhood in particular mm-hmm. That I think are really interesting now. So like a lot of times when, like particularly the way they shot Broccoli in the scenes where he comes in, it's shot from like almost beneath him mm-hmm. the way that I always thought of it as like, oh, they're giving the perspective of a child, but it does make him look more like creepy and almost inhuman and monstrous in yeah. the way that it creates those shadows on his face and some of the other things. The fact that Jane is locked in a closet when we're introduced to her yeah. and they bring her out. I think that's really interesting. There's a couple other elements from when she's at Lowood that kind of have that flavor to it too, that I hadn't necessarily thought of with that specific lens, but I think it is very gothic throughout the movie.
Yeah. You've seen Young Frankenstein, right? Mel Brooks?
Yes. It was my little brother Patrick's favorite movie when we were kids.
That's one of my parents' favorite films. But that one is like kind of made in homage to like the kind of gothic movies of this time mm-hmm. period. And I feel like I think about that most often when like I'm thinking about all the things that make the 43 Jane Eyre scary. And I'm like, oh, like literally Mel Brooks was parroting that, like with the matte painting of the overly dramatic, spooky looking castle on the hill and like the regular like lightning flashes and like the dun 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 kind of all the stuff yeah. that they're doing there.
Oh so, God, the music in the 43 is very much
yes.
This melodrama, this all these gothic things that we've talked about.
Absolutely.
For sure.
My other most gothic adaptation choice was your favorite, the 2011.
That was the one that I thought of. And I was like, I bet that's on Piper's list.
It is. Because like first thing I wrote is that like, as you said about the trailer, I think they literally made and advertised this film as kind of like a spooky story mm-hmm. because the trailer is rather like creepy. You said that he looks like a demon, like at one moment. Like
truly, they like lit. I remember I didn't watch this movie because at the time the 2011 came out, it was very much in my wheelhouse of things I would enjoy. Because my favorite movie was the 2005 Pride and Prejudice, but the spook scares I was not going to do. Yes. And I looked at this trailer and it looked really scary and really upsetting. Mm-hmm. And the trailer of the 2011 was my first introduction to Jane Eyre. So when you told me about having watched Jane Eyre on the podcast, which you can go back and listen to the clip of that on our feed, if you feel like it, it's not great, but whatever. That was my impression of it, was it was this scary, haunted, there's some romance in it, but it's mostly spook scares.
Yeah. And so they obviously, that was again, I think an intentional choice. They used it in the advertising. This movie also has a lot of prominent use of shadow to create kind of mystery and suspense. Mm-hmm. They do a lot more of kind of the natural lighting techniques where we have scenes that feel as if they're lit solely by the fireplace or by a candle or by the moonlight coming in from a window. And a lot of kind of the spooky elements that feel prominent here are, so Jane is kind of afraid or set on edge by the house very early on. And there's a lot of interaction she has by looking at these kind of ominous paintings that are hung in the house that are both kind of suggestive with their nudity. But then there's also frightening paintings too, that feel a bit more kind of like those, you know, famous pieces where it's the end of days. And it's all the people eating each other and tearing each other apart. And these things are emphasized in the film by both the visual language with these things that we're talking about, but then it's even really emphasized in the dialogue when we early on see her caring for Adele, and she starts kind of trying to sort of tell a spooky story to her, talking about this guy trash, this monster. Mm-hmm. And then Adele turns it right back on her and she's like, "Have you seen the lady, the vampire who walks the halls of Thornfield? My nurse said that she'll fade through the walls and she's going to drink your blood," which is again another kind of foreshadowing thing for later when Bertha actually bites her brother. And it sets up this whole element of suspense and scariness where it's like, are these things real? Is this something no, it's a silly child. She's just being a goofy girl. Boy, I wish there were more lights in this scary old house.
The boy, I wish there were more lights in the scary old house is a sentiment I can relate to quite a bit. but I think as you were talking, I was thinking about a couple other movies and how they're, I think a lot of them have the gothic elements. I think of our TV shows, I would say the 83 is probably the most gothic, if only because Rochester is so very melodramatic in it. Yes. And the way they light all those garden scenes and the fact that they have them at night and all of that stuff, I think that's a lot of those tragic romance elements that Piper loves so very much come through, I think, the most in the 83.
I do.
And then I think a lot of the ones that we often describe as softer are the ones that are least gothic. William Hurt one is one that I always think of because that does not lean into the spook scares. It is just a sad, sweet lady.
Yeah. No, it's so funny. I was just thinking of that one too. That one feels very 90s glow. It's just very soft kind of sweetness. He's very much a likable guy. Then not so much the suspense, more just the romance.
Yeah. I think the 2006 has a similar yes, there's obviously things that are frightening in that, but they are not leaning into that. They are not trying to make you feel that suspense. They're not trying to make you feel like it's spooky. Yeah. There's a mystery there, but it's more intriguing than it is creepy.
Exactly. No, I completely agree.
And I think that that's one of the big differences between the two that you listed is are they trying to lean into the creepiness and the mystery of it versus the slightly more oh, that's interesting. I wonder what that's about. Yeah. Versus you should get out of that house.
And it's something that I really love. It's funny. So I've been both reading some spooky stories recently and then also writing some things. And I think just because my it's spooky season and I'm thinking about this a lot, I'll be writing a scene that's meant to be very cute and sweet, but then I'll kind of pause and read over it and I'm like, boy, if I just changed a tiny thing, this goes from adorable to very alarming very fast. And it's it's so interesting how just the most minute change can turn something into this kind of threatening, ominous thing instead of just being oh no, everyone's on the same page here, this is cool, we all like this, versus wait, is there a crazy lady in this house? Like, what's going on? Hang on.
I also think it's interesting as we talk about this too, it's making me think about when there are certain times where Jane Eyre is adapted more than other times. And I think those are often times where they were really leaning into that melodrama. And it makes me think a lot about the international adaptations. Mm-hmm. So Sangdil was 52. That really into the melodrama of it.
Yes.
Slightly less on the spook scares, although I will say the way they did Bertha in that was very scary.
Yeah.
But really into the melodrama. And I think that that's a genre that I think of a lot when I think of Bollywood stuff is mm-hmm. the melodrama. And then the other two were the, I want to say it was 57. I'm not going to remember when the Italian one was.
Yeah, I'm not
sure. The Italian one, and then the 71 for the Spanish one. Both mm-hmm. very melodramatic shows.
Yeah.
I would say, again, like, they have more spookiness than some of the adaptations, but they're a lot more that melodramatic element of the Gothic, which is just interesting to think about, kind of how they choose to highlight that.
And this makes me think of something that I shared with you when we talked about melodrama and my writing, A Dance with the Dead, is a video essay that I watched that talked about why melodrama translates so well between languages and cultures. And because even if you don't like understand the exact words that they're saying, the level of emotion that they are putting out there is like any human can connect to that and understand that. It's like, I see that sorrow. I feel that joy. Like it goes beyond like language, which is really cool.
Yeah. I think like transcending the different cultures and the different language barriers and that sort of stuff, like that's very much what I see in especially those two adaptations we watched where we didn't have subtitles. We didn't have any of that stuff. We have one more that we're going to watch like that that is coming up. And it's interesting. I'm going to keep an eye out for that because I think that is very much how I think of my understanding of those. And I wonder how much they truly are more melodramatic than some of the other ones, particularly the ones that came out around the same time, or how much that's what stuck with me because that was the part that I could understand.
Right. No, that's a really good read. So Lillian, for this next section, this is kind of my like TED talk and also pretty much if I was doing another film theory thesis paper specifically about Jane Eyre, I think this would be a wonderful kind of thesis to go off of. But there's kind of, I think you can look at Jane Eyre based on, you know, the information that we have at the beginning part mm-hmm. of the story versus the information we have once we've finished reading it and how that changes how we interpret the events of the book. And I want to talk about with that the two types of horror that we find in Jane Eyre. There is the horror of what could be and the unknown.
Mm.
And then there is the horror of what is and the ugly truth. And I have like some cool things about this. So like just to kind of throw out to start this discussion is what is scarier? The incomprehension of otherworldly dangers like ghosts and vampires and creatures of the night and vengeful spirits that we can't understand, or the real life horrors and sorrow of crippling mental illness, cruelty towards children, poverty and destitution, and the cold judgment that society puts on people in those conditions, because all of that is found in this novel.
Holy shit, Viper. That's such a great question. I think it's so interesting to me how differently I feel about both of those things. And I think that some of this is probably why you and I see these things differently mm-hmm. And enjoy them differently. Because not to get into my own psychology more than I already have on this podcast, this is secretly Lillian's therapy hour. But I think for me, the other horrors are more tangibly worse, right? Mm-hmm. Like they make me feel sad and hurt. But I also get this other feeling of possibility to fix that. Like, there's something real about that. There's a problem I could attack. Like, I am a problem solver. I'm a planner. I love control. That's the one that my therapist doesn't love about me. but I think that there's something tangible there that I could do something about or move forward with. It's why I'm always talking about bringing Bertha in to live with my house and to live in my house and how Jane needs a hug and how I would love to beat the shit out of broccoli. Like, those all feel so much more like tangible problems I can deal with, where this supernatural horror is so deeply out of my control and gives me a feeling of like, not just fear, but also like a out of control uncertainty and like this other layer of terror that I do not enjoy.
Now, this is so fascinating. And I think this is also what makes us very well paired hosts, is because I think my answer to this question is, if I really sit down and think about it, the real life horrors and tragedy, that scares me more because I know that's happening in the world still. And what makes me sad and like upset about it is that I feel like on the large scale, I can't change that. I can't make those things better. And I can't even some of the like, you know, cruelties that we do to one another as humanity, it's hard to rationalize it. And so that, I think when I think about that for a long time, that makes me really scared and upset and kind of takes down my level of hope. Whereas the like supernatural things, I'm like, well, those aren't real. So I am comforted by that knowledge to say those things will never get me. But who knows, like other horrible things that are real in our life can. So very different approaches to this kind of question.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I think the fundamental difference between those two things is the same way we see it, but the way we feel about that is so different. Because to you, it's like, that is so outside of something I could influence. It's, and you're totally right. Like, my belief that I could do something about children being abused in the world, I could only do that on the micro. Like,
but that's that is something, the important thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Which like, but like, I think that that's, that to you, that you can, you have control over these ghosts and ghouls and goblins and all the spooks, because they live in your head and you can control what lives in your head and you can enjoy that when you want to enjoy it. And it can go away when you don't want to you experience that anymore. So it's so interesting to me that like, for the same reasons, we come to the opposite conclusion.
Exactly. And to add a third level to this very interesting kind of thought exploration is when you think about the fact that the sorrows of reality is what inspires the horror of our stories. And in very particular examples that we see in this novel, you could say, like, so when we talk about ghosts, that is oftentimes a person's inability to cope with grief or loss. You don't want to believe that person's gone forever, so it's better to be frightened by a ghost that might remain than to think that you'll never see them again. Or with like vampires, such as referenced in the 2011, I did a little Googling on this one because I was like, what's some of the metaphors that are often used with vampirism? And a lot of that that I came down to that can be used to kind of talk about that is these ideas of an alienation from society. And then also, because there's a lot of like sexual undertones to like the drinking of blood and things like that. And the fact that vampires have victims, a lot of that is like often related, if you want to put on your, you know, metaphor hat, to kind of like sexual assault and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, there are these, there's also all kinds of like crazy, interesting things you could get into if you want to talk about zombies, especially in modern day fiction. That's often like the rampant consumerism of like, or like, you know, mindless like masses and things like that. But all of these things originally stemmed from people not understanding something about the world. And so their brains jumped to like, what could this possibly be? It's probably this monster or this creature or this spirit, but it's all kind of based in actual real world fears and sorrow, which is like, ooh, you know, it's spooky and it's sad and it's therapy. I love it all.
But it makes me think of a particular, like with Wuthering Heights as well. I feel like these, Wuthering Heights comes to mind a lot when we're talking about the gothic things. I saw one version of it and I'm like, that's the most gothic thing I'll ever watch.
It's very dark.
But I will say, like, it makes me think about who the Brontes were and being out on the moors like that and having these conversations and these stories that they started writing as children were stories that were escapism and turned the very real tragedy that was happening all around them into these spooky monsters and these more like there were heroes fighting them and villains that were perpetuating that. But making it the supernatural was, it's interesting to think about the kids that would do that, that would play in the supernatural as they lived in these dark lives, and to see how well Charlotte Bronte took that idea and grounded the scariness and the spookiness that Jane experiences and the belief in the supernatural that Jane and Rochester share in these dark, shattered childhoods.
Yeah, 100%. Ooh, it's something about the horror genre, similar to the fantasy and sci-fi genre. It's often a commentary on different kind of like trauma, well, like different social issues that are happening at the time when they're written, at least, you know, the big influential ones are. And so it's always kind of a filter that you put over something that's actually going on, that's a big problem. And you can say, well, we're going to talk about it as if it was like a zombie apocalypse, or we're going to talk about like this vampire who's stalking this woman because he wants to drink her blood, kind of a thing. But what is that like based on in reality and other things like that? So they just have interesting kind of like parallels.
Yeah, the parallels that you're mentioning there remind me a little bit of a subgenre of romance that I do consume, which is monster romances.
Yeah.
And I was talking on Care So Much to an author, or not an author, a scholar. She's getting her master's degree and has written a thesis about monster romances as specifically that kind of genre where, and she had a term for it that I'm not remembering, but it's basically that idea of you're taking this like sci-fi and fantasy. Sci-fi does this a lot, but I think that we see some of that in this gothic literature and in Jane Eyre is imagining how the world could be. So it's, you spend some time with almost this escapism, and to escape into something dark, that is a commentary on the humanity and the world that we live in.
Yeah.
If you're escaping to a world where you're imagining a monster or you're imagining the living in this house with creepy laughter and a man who's secretly married and has his wife locked in the attic and all of these things, if that's like your escape, what is your reality looking like?
Right.
And what are the men in life that you dream of, Rochester?
Yeah. It's because it also kind of leads into that discussion that we have all the time when we talk about romance, which is, I love this in fiction. I don't want this in reality. and again, it's kind of, it's that escapism into like, kind of like how, why people often like to watch like spooky things. There's like the thrill of what's scary, and same thing for like riding roller coasters, you know, like you want to kind of test,
I don't enjoy.
You want to test your boundary of safety, but all the while you have the safety bar pulled over you. So you know you're going to be okay. So long as they've done the inspections on the roller coasters and it's not Final Destination. but I think it's the same thing with like escaping into like a monster romance or a gothic romance, is saying like, I've heard about these horrifying things and I want to kind of walk the line and always have control over that thing that should scare me. It's almost like a way to kind of take power back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's similar to what you were saying about like the idea of a vampire. I'd never thought of that before, being about sexual assault. Like that idea of like, why would women who've experienced that want to live in a metaphor of vampire? And it's like, some of that is like, we all agree that the vampire is evil. Like we're all in agreement that stealing someone's blood is bad and you shouldn't do it. And they often get their comeuppance. Like that's, I think, a really important thing to understand that had never occurred to me before.
Yeah.
I'm not going to suddenly get into horror, but it's good job, fiction people. You did it.
You did it.
You made it so scary. I simply cannot.
And Lillian, we did it. We talked about gothic elements in Jane Eyre.
Yay!
You took control. You faced your fears.
Yeah! Woo! Hooray, the real victor of this podcast is me. But I do want to say, so we're not going to rate how gothic it is because it's a 10 out of 10, baby.
I'm going to give it 9 spooky skeletons.
How could they get their 10th spooky skeleton?
Rochester have someone dies.
Kiss and, a corpse?
Yeah. Yeah, Rochester dies. And then also a chain catches his blindness and is now blind too, but she's alone.
Catches his blindness?
It's contagious. She kisses him. She gives him the kiss of death. He dies. And then she gets blind. And then she wanders the moors without being able to see. Yeah.
Okay. So that's too spooky and sad for me. But I do something that we, Piper and I, have been talking about for a while that we are now going to share with you, our lovely listeners who we love so very much, is our time with Jane Eyre is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. It is not done. Do not freak out. we have, this is our 10th to last episode. Mm-hmm. So I've referenced a couple of times things that we have on the list. We know what those next 10 episodes are going to be. We will not be sharing them with you guys in case we change our mind.
It's a surprise.
But we do... we are going to be finishing up talking about Jane Eyre at the 2-year anniversary of our podcast. I'm not going to talk about it now because I'm going to talk about it every time that we talk about the fact that this podcast is ending. Mm-hmm. And even thinking about talking about it is making me cry a little bit. How much I absolutely adore all of you guys as our listeners and how incredible of a journey this has been. We want to end this when it feels right to end it. Yes. And not when we both hate it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you hate it.
Yeah.
We want it to be something that is complete and lovely. There's a chance that it comes back in different forms. I've talked about doing different versions, different seasons of similar things, commenting on different period dramas. But for now, we're going to be wrapping up talking about Jane Eyre. Our last episode will be the beginning of January. We will talk about it quite a bit as it comes up in advance. But we're heading towards the end of this thing.
Yeah. And we wanted to let you know to emotionally prepare, but now you can know that you really need to savor every single episode and send us so many 5-star reviews and so many nice comments and so many emails at airbuds and airbuds@gmail.com and send it with all of your friends and your family. Thanksgiving is coming up soon. And once Uncle So-and-so starts sharing his unpopular political opinions, that's when you jump in and you say, hey, there's this podcast called Airbuds and it's only got like 9 episodes left, so you guys should really watch it. It's really, really good. That's really fun. And pass the gravy.
Play it really, play like our episode where we define erotica really loud for your whole family.
Nice.
That'll I feel like that's Uncle what Dan. Grandma wants to know at Thanksgiving. it'll change the energy of a room. That's all I'm saying.
That's for dang sure. I will also save my big ones for once we get closer to the end. But Lillian said so many nice things. I also love you guys. I'm not over here just being like, oh, yeah, well, I'm sick of you all and I want to get out of here. No, we love you guys so much.
Well, and there will be an episode next week, obviously. We are going to be watching something that we have been talking about for a long time. A lot of you have suggested we watch this. I think the first person in my notes is Julie. So thank you, Julie. But we are going to be watching To Walk Invisible, which is the apparently good Bronte story that came out in 2016. It is a 2-part movie, I think. I think technically it's listed as a TV show. If I know we like to reference where you can watch things, you do have to purchase this one with money, $5. Sorry, guys.
Ooh. We're going to share our $5 and watch it together with Lillian's
Apple. Don't tell people. Don't tell people about the rules. I'm not Tommy. You can't just give away my login.
I'm not sharing your login. I'm just saying that we're friends and friends share with each other.
We're a single household legally.
Yeah, it's true. In our hearts.
In our hearts, we're a single household. Sam and Piper are my parents.
It's true. But guys, thank you for listening to this. Maybe you're listening to it on Halloween itself. So probably there's a lot of kids waiting outside your door about to break the windows asking for their candy. So make sure you give them the big candy bars if you want to be cool. Otherwise, we're going to tell them to toilet paper your house.
It's yeah, if fair. You're a kid listening to this, first of all, what do you mean? You're a child listening to a podcast about Jane Eyre? Honey. Unless you're like a cool teen, in which case, like, great job.
Oh, yeah.
Go TP a house.
Yeah, have fun, guys.
Like, and if the cops ask, we didn't tell you to do that.
No.
That was like, a joke.
Officer, I was sitting at home reading Jane Eyre all night long. I don't know what you're talking about.
We'll be your alibi.
Yeah, we'll back you up.
Podcast can be an alibi. Don't ever question that.
So happy Halloween, you guys. Happy spooky season. We love you. And happy Jane Eyre reading and watching.
Bye. Bye.